I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Last century, the U.S. government, with the help of state officials, incarcerated tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of women who were suspected of being promiscuous, of having a sexually transmitted infection, an STI. The program was called the American Plan, begun ostensibly to protect soldiers heading off to fight in World War I. But before long, it was used to round up mostly poor minority women who were forced to undergo physical exams, were incarcerated largely without due process, and forcibly given painful and dubious treatments involving injections of mercury and arsenic. Sometimes they were sterilized. Our guest Scott Stern has written a book about this little-known and shocking program titled The Trials of Nina McCall, about a young woman who was swept up in this program and, after released, sued the people who tormented her. The program was eventually stopped in the 1970s, although many of the laws that enabled the plan are still on the books, and it remains one of the largest and longest-lasting mass quarantines in U.S. history. Scott Stern joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. He is a historian, also a student at Yale Law School. Scott, nice to have you with us, and thank you for writing this book.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. You know, most of us know about the Tuskegee syphilis study, in which black men were denied treatment knowing that they had syphilis. I did not know about this program. Was it hidden, or have we just forgotten?
It wasn't hidden per se. Much like Tuskegee, it was openly discussed by public health authorities for decades, but most people in the general population have just never heard of it. And there's a number of reasons for that, but the most important one, in my opinion, is that the people who would be most likely to speak out against this program called the American Plan, the women who were actually locked up, had their voices systematically silenced. So women inside detention institutions where they were being held to be treated for STIs would often not be allowed to write letters home. Their mail would be censored. Many of these institutions didn't allow visitors. And then once these women were released, they often there were huge incentives for them not to talk about where they'd spent all these months, because they might not be able to find jobs. They might not be able to find partners. Sexually transmitted infections were so stigmatized in the early 20th century that during the 1930s, the U.S. Surgeon General wasn't able to say the word syphilis on the radio.
Because it was just too shocking. One did not say a word that had something to do with sex?
Basically, yeah. I mean, there were morality codes limiting what you could say in print or on radio. And this pattern of marginalization, this pattern of stigmatization is really the reason we've never heard of it, because the people most likely to speak out about what was actually happening had their voices silenced in this way.
Well, we'll get to Nina's story, because she went to court, and there are lots of court transcripts, which helps to tell her story. But let's set the stage. As you mentioned, this is essentially the beginning of the 20th century. How rampant were sexually transmitted diseases or illnesses?
STIs were very common in the 19th and early 20th century, in large part because there were no effective treatments. In the 1910s, there was a treatment developed called Salvarsan, which was based on arsenic. It was marginally effective at treating syphilis, but it was so monstrously toxic that virtually no one could handle the full complement of injections. There's a great book about New York in the mid-19th century that estimates one in seven New Yorkers.
One in seven.
One in seven had an STI. So these were very common, and until the advent of antibiotics in the 1940s, there really were no particularly effective and non-extremely toxic treatments. So if you got it, you had it, and so many people had STIs. So they were a valid public health problem. The concern, though, that motivated the creation of this program of mass incarceration was not the profusion of STIs. Rather, it was that 1.5 million young men were gathering in military training camps in 1917. And there was a fear that these young men were going to be infected with syphilis and gonorrhea. So now this wasn't just a threat to health. It was a threat to national security.
And the threat were the women, some of them prostitutes, some of them not. But the threat were the women to these men.
That was the position of those in power, that promiscuous young women were going to infect the nation's soldiers and it was going to harm the war effort. The immense stupidity of this program was that, you know, it takes two to tango. So
sure.
it makes no sense just to lock up women and not men. And at the same time, there were plenty of men having sex with troops as well. And it doesn't make sense in that way than to just lock up women. But of course, the vast majority of people locked up under the American plan were women.
Well, it's also an interesting time. There was a huge influx of immigrants coming into the country at this time, many of them from Eastern Europe, and many of them, I guess, believed to be diseased. When we hear about the response to these immigrants, often they were seen as carriers of something dangerous.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this was very much a response to huge immigration in the late 19th and early 20th century. And a lot of these immigrants were from places that had not previously sent terribly many immigrants to the U.S. A lot of these immigrants were non-white or perceived as non-white. And so they were deemed particularly threatening by right. those in power. And at the same time, women were beginning to get the vote across the country. Women were beginning to work. Women were banding together politically and speaking out. And the rate of premarital sex was skyrocketing. The rate of divorce was going up. Young women were living on their own. So this was a response to mass immigration. It was a response to urbanization. But it was also a response to women getting power, especially working class and non-white women.
You could frame it as a kind of war on women at this time, based on what you just said there.
Yeah. And there was a government agent in 1917 in San Francisco who I found a letter he wrote where he literally called this, quote, waging war on the women. This was very explicitly about controlling quote-unquote deviant young women.
There was something called the American Social Hygiene Association that got started. And I guess on the one hand, you could see some well-intentioned people saying, look, there are these transmittable diseases. We don't have a cure. We have to do something about it. What was the role or the goal, I guess, of this association?
So the American the ASHA, as it was known, was the largest private organization that was dedicated to wiping out STIs. And for the record, it still exists today. It's known as the American Sexual Health Association, and its website has a very sanitized account of its history.
But, oh, interesting.
The ASHA was really designed to funnel people and to funnel money into combating STIs, and it was the premier group promoting this program, the American Plan, that resulted in tens, probably hundreds of thousands of people being locked up. The ASHA was largely funded by John D. Rockefeller Jr. Over the years, he gave the equivalent of tens of millions of dollars to the ASHA, and then the ASHA funneled that money quietly to state health departments and to cities. The ASHA also sent agents out onto the streets to walk around and look for quote-unquote suspicious women. The ASHA kind of symbolizes this public-private partnership, and it was very important in promoting the American plan. And a lot of very prominent people were members, like Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yeah, I was surprised to read that. I mean, I guess this notion that there was this threat to public health and perhaps a war threat as well.
Yeah, I mean, in 1917, as all of these young men were gathering in military training camps, there was a lot of talk at the highest levels of the federal government. What are we going to do to prevent STIs? And they tested the recruits to the Army and the Navy, and they found that between 1 in 5 and 1 in 6 of those young men had an STI. So they felt they had to do something. And unfortunately, they launched this highly punitive program of locking up tens, probably hundreds of thousands of women. And with the help of the ASHA and with the help of other very prominent individuals, they embarked upon this program that then lasted for decades.
Well, and the notion was if there was a reasonable suspicion that a woman could have a sexually transmitted infection, that she could be essentially arrested. How was that defined?
So, yeah, that basically what would happen is a government agent would walk around and any woman whom he, quote, reasonably suspected of having syphilis or gonorrhea, he could have detained, forcibly examined, and then if she proved to be infected and at a time when the false positive rates could be as high as 25%, she'd be locked up without due process, without a trial, without a hearing, anything. So reasonable suspicion was a legal standard, and it was intentionally vague in order to allow authority figures to have as much latitude as possible in choosing which women to lock up. So I found examples of reasonable suspicion that were a woman walking down the street alone, a woman walking down the street
with
a man.
Just by herself, considered...
Yep.
potentially promiscuous?
Yeah, that was a huge threat, apparently. A woman sitting at a restaurant alone, a woman sitting at a restaurant with a man, a woman drinking alcohol. Basically anything that authority figures wanted could count as reasonable suspicion. And this standard was so vague that it gave male authority figures the ability to lock up women who jilted them. So there's a number of examples I found where a health officer or a cop would say something like, sleep with me or I will have you locked up under this program. And if a woman refused, she could and sometimes was locked up.
Well, Nina McCall was 18 years old. She was living in Michigan, a poor white woman, and she was arrested under this program.
Yeah. So Nina was in the year 1918. She had just turned 18. She was walking down the street in her 2,000 person town in central Michigan when the deputy sheriff, a man who she knew, she was friends with his daughter, detained her and told her that the local health officer suspected she had an STI and he would have to examine her. Not knowing what else to do, Nina, along with her mother, went to the health officer's office, and there he examined her. It was the first gynecological exam the young woman had ever had, and this was a time when gynecological exams were not common. The health officer took slides of something Nina couldn't see and came back just a few minutes later and said, I pronounce this young woman slightly infected with gonorrhea. Mm. And Nina said that couldn't possibly be true. She'd never had sex. And the health officer said, I didn't say you'd had sex. I just said you had gonorrhea. And if Nina's recollection is to be believed, and there's no reason it isn't, he added with stunning inaccuracy, there are other ways to get it.
Meaning who knows what?
Meaning right? it brings to mind kind of the rumors during the HIV/AIDS epidemic, like getting it from toilet seats and that kind of thing. But of course, that's ludicrous.
And this was a guy named Dr. Carney, and he was the local doctor there. You describe him as being someone obsessed with public health.
Yeah, Dr. Carney had a kind of almost like messianic approach to public health. He was known and eventually hated in his small community in Michigan because he was so avid about promoting health. He would have people quarantined if they had influenza or if they had typhus. He made people follow laws that they'd been ignoring about like pasteurizing milk. He was very, very certain of his own ability and his own authority. And that really, to me, is encapsulated by a moment with Nina where after he diagnoses her with gonorrhea, she says that couldn't possibly be true. He says, young lady, do you mean to call me a liar? And Nina responds, yes, sir, I do, if you say I'm infected. And you know, that moment is particularly striking to me because it's hard to overstate just how bold a young woman would have had to have been in the year 1918 to call a male authority figure a liar to his face.
We're almost having a break here, but he, I guess, was known for doing what he did to Nina. You describe at some point her describing, you know, there was blood, I guess, in her underwear as a result of some of these exams.
Right. She started feeling a lot of pain right after being examined, and it just indicates that he did not do a terribly good job, and it draws the whole diagnosis he made into question.
Not doing a good job, meaning he hurt her.
He hurt her, and you know there are a lot of documented examples of men, of doctors and health officers doing these examinations and causing women tremendous pain, causing blood, you know, really doing a pretty shoddy job in order to get these diagnoses.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Scott Stern. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Trials of Nina McCall, subtitled Sex, Surveillance, and the Decades-Long Government Plan to Imprison, quote-unquote, Promiscuous Women. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Scott Stern about his new book. And if you want to check out some of what he found, like a warning flyer given to women arrested by the Moral Squad, you can take a look at our social media. We have posted and we'll be posting them on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So you can, in a sense, follow along as we talk about this really shocking time in American history. Now, where was Nina McCall? Where was she sent or where was she detained?
So Nina was detained in St. Louis, Michigan, which is a very small town, dead set in the middle of Michigan. And then she was sent more than an hour from her home to an institution called the Bay City Detention Hospital. This was one of, you know, dozens, probably hundreds of institutions across the country where women with STIs or promiscuous women were sent for weeks or for months to be treated for sexually transmitted infections and also to be, quote unquote, morally reformed. And these institutions were variously called detention hospitals, reformatories. One woman in the 1940s even called them concentration camps.
I noticed that. I mean, that's obviously very concentration camp means many things, but one is they couldn't leave.
Right. No, I mean, these were penal institutions, and sometimes they were literally housed in the same building as a jail, and they were incredibly coercive and punitive places. They had many of them had barbed wire, armed guards, electric charged fences. There were really kind of gruesome punishments that some women were subjected to. And as you mentioned, some women locked in these institutions for no crime other than having an STI were sterilized.
Mm. Let me read something you include in this book. This is a woman named Miriam Van Waters. She was, as you describe her, an idealistic female prison reformer. This is 1922. And she is talking about the kind of corporal punishment that could be given to some of these women who were held in these centers. She goes to say, this is tough stuff, too, I should add. Flogging is still practiced in nearly half of the institutions studied. The most frequent cause of flogging are running away and sex perversions. Starvation or limited diet is found in two-thirds, the restricted diet lasting from a period of a few days to a period of months. Solitary confinement in black cells is still used. Isolation behind bars or within steel cages is found. Some form of segregation or meditation being almost universal. Other punishments are cold water baths, doses of drugs that produce nausea, drenching the body with a stream from a fire hose, tying up and other forms of physical restraint, shaving the head, suspension from school, deprivation of medical attention, and nameless and terrible punishment, she goes on to say. This is torture.
Yes, it was. And it wasn't just these brutal forms of corporal punishment. And she didn't, by the way, mention all of them. But, you know, the other, and I think even worse form of torture was the medical treatments women endured. From the 1910s into the 40s, among the most common treatments for syphilis was the injections of mercury. And we now know that, you know, there's some limited evidence it kills the microbe that causes syphilis, but it doesn't cure you once you have the infection. It will, however, kill you, and in the process, it will hurt a tremendous amount. Nina McCall in the Bay City Detention Hospital got repeated injections of mercury, and she talks about her hair starting to fall out, her teeth starting to fall out, just tremendous pain that this caused her. And this happened to tens of thousands of women around the country by their government.
Well, and even in Bedford Hills, New York, there was a reformatory. This is even more horrifying about women who transgressed the rules were handcuffed with their hands behind their backs, fastened to the cell grating by another pair of handcuffs attached to those of their wrists so that in some cases their toes or balls of their feet could only touch the floor. Again, you know, this is the kind of treatment one hears about in a concentration camp, for instance.
Right. And we should be clear about what motivated these punishments. You know, among the most common reasons that people would be punished in this manner was what Miriam Van Waters called, quote unquote, sex perversion,
right,
which meant, you know, women having sex with women or women being romantic with women. And there was this huge fear that women in these institutions were going to embark on, quote unquote, lesbian relationships. And there was also a very racist fear at the time that black women were the quote-unquote aggressors in these relationships. And so women who were seen to be deviating from the prevailing sexual norms at the time, which was very much quote-unquote respectable and Victorian, they would be punished especially brutally.
Hmm. But there were riots. Some of these women burned down, you know, parts of their detention centers. There were hunger strikes. There were escapees. Many of these women, in a sense, fought back.
Yeah, that's the part of this story that I think has been least covered by historians, and it's also the part I think is most important, that for decades, women continually resisted the American plan. As you said, there were hunger strikes, there were probably thousands of escapes over the years. A lot of women physically assaulted their captors. They did something called smashing out, where they would break every window in the place. And I found a record in upstate New York of a woman leaping from a moving train rather than return to an American plan institution. I found a record of a woman in Seattle leaping from a window to her death rather than stay in an American plan institution. And this pattern of resistance continued for decades, and in the 60s and 70s, it actually paid dividends and caused the sort of defeat of the American plan in many places.
Well, and were they in every state? I mean, did every state have some form of detention center or centers?
Every U.S. state had the American plan in force, so they had some form of detention hospital or reformatory. And it wasn't just U.S. states. It was anywhere the United States had power. So this happened in Puerto Rico. This happened in the Philippines. This happened in the Dominican Republic and in what at the time was the territory of Hawaii. And in all those places as well, the American plan was enforced and there were these penal institutions.
Were other countries doing something similar to this at this time?
Other countries were doing similar things. You know, STIs were a huge problem around the world. And so Britain in 1918 passed something called the Defense of the Realm Act, which enabled something very similar to the American plan. But the difference was in England, it was one law that sort of applied across Britain. And in the United States, the American plan was enabled by state and city level laws. So if you defeated it in, say, Pennsylvania, it would still continue in New Jersey and in Connecticut and in Virginia and wherever. So in Britain in the 1910s, a group of radical women, many Quakers, launched a resistance program and lobbied for the repeal of this law. And within a couple months, they succeeded and the law was repealed. A similar pattern happened in World War II. They passed another law enabling something similar to the American plan, and then people fought it and it was repealed. And that was possible because there was one law, whereas in the U.S., it was this system of laws. And after World War I ended, there was virtually no federal oversight. So this was so diffuse, it was impossible to defeat in one fell swoop.
And there are still laws on the books.
Yeah,
in what, 50 states? All 50
Yeah,
states?
Every state has some has its American plan law in some form remaining on the books to this day. And these laws have never been overturned by the courts. In fact, courts repeatedly affirm the constitutionality of these laws. And they're now pretty firmly ensconced in the public health power of the state. And I should be clear that quarantine can be a valid public health tool. The problem is when it's motivated by stereotypes or stigma or simple hatred of women. And many of these laws explicitly identified prostitutes as quote-unquote de facto reasonably suspected of having STIs, which we now know flies in the face of data. And it's an incredibly sexist stereotype.
Were the laws originally written, were they gender neutral but just carried out in a more sexist way?
Yeah, most of the laws were gender neutral. They say, quote unquote, any person reasonably suspected of having an STI. Some of the laws would, as I just said, like identify prostitutes or madams of brothels as de facto reasonably suspected. But the vast majority of these laws were gender neutral and just enforced in incredibly sexist ways.
And just to put the prostitution into some kind of historical context, it seems that it up until maybe the 20th century, largely run by women, but then men begin to take over running houses, you know, brothels.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, a lot of people, I think, don't know this, but in the 19th and even early 20th century, prostitution in many places, especially out west, was a relatively respectable profession. Especially madams were sometimes pillars of their communities. The brothels were very famous. Some are still remembered to this day. What happened in the 1910s is that there was this big program that went hand in hand with the American plan to shut down the brothels. There was a belief among those in power, men as well as women, that if you close the brothels, prostitution would simply disappear. But what ended up happening was they closed the brothels and it just forced women out onto the streets, which is much more dangerous. Mm-hmm. And it took the business model away from the hands of women and put it into the hands of exploitative men. So there were a lot fewer madams, but suddenly there were a lot more pimps. And it just became much more dangerous and much more highly policed. And it didn't in any place, wipe out prostitution.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Scott Stern, our guest on Radio Times today. He's got a new book we are talking about called The Trials of Nina McCall, subtitled Sex Surveillance and the Decades-Long Government Plan to Imprison Promiscuous Women, promiscuous in quotation marks. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, we have put some images up on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter so that you can have a sense of what we're talking about in terms of what things actually look like. Well, we talked about the fact that so many of these women, in a sense, revolted while they were being held in these detention centers. But Nina McCall chose to do something different, which was to take her, I called them tormentors, but take the doctor. There was a woman that essentially harassed her after she was released, to take them to court. What got her thinking to do that?
Well, that was kind of a last-ditch effort by Nina to get the harassment that was enabled by the American plan to stop. She'd spent about 3 months behind bars being injected with mercury and being made to scrub floors and wash dishes, and eventually she was released. And she got home and, first of all, couldn't find a job because everyone knew where she'd been and it was so stigmatized. And then this woman named Ida Peck, who was a government agent, came around repeatedly and told her that she had to continue taking injections of mercury on an outpatient basis.
Even after she had, in a sense, served her time.
Exactly. And this was very common for women who'd served their time under the American plan. And Nina did this for a little bit, but it hurt a great deal, and it further got in the way of her being able to get a job. So at first, she tried a number of strategies before bringing a lawsuit. First, she married a man named Claire Rock, who was a laborer and part-time carpenter in Central Michigan. She explicitly said later that she married Rock because she thought he would provide her some protection from the government agent and cause this harassment to stop. But on her wedding night, she found out that Rock had only married her because he'd heard she'd been in the Bay City Detention Hospital. And based on that fact, he thought he could, in effect, prostitute her for his own profit.
Wow.
So Nina couldn't abide by that, but she also couldn't abide by, you know, the continuing injections of mercury. So her next strategy was escape. She fled. She traveled around Central Michigan and then hid out in Detroit for several months. First with a friend, but then largely by herself. And this didn't work, though, because the government agent started harassing her mother. So Nina returned, and only then did she decide to sue the government. She needed this harassment to stop.
And it sounded the way you describe her relationship with her mother, that they were very close. Her mother, in a sense, her protector, or certainly trying to protect her daughter from this system.
That's right. She and her mother do seem to be very close. Her mother was pretty sick at the time, and Nina was caring for her, so the escape was a pretty extreme measure. And, you know, her mother had gone with her when Nina was first diagnosed with gonorrhea in Dr. Carney's office. And her mother had tried to have Nina kept at home. She said, you know, I'll get a job. We'll pay for her to stay at home and we'll get her medical treatments if you say she needs these. And the doctor basically said, no, that ain't going to happen. Nina and her mother were close. In fact, her mother and two of her aunts were the only people Nina had told where she'd spent these 3 months. But rumor got around.
Well, if she had been allowed to stay home, this would have been the placard, I guess, on the door or on their house or apartment. Venereal disease. No person shall enter or leave this house until this card is officially removed. The removing or defacing of this notice without written authority from the Board of Health is punishable by fine or imprisonment by order of the Board of Health.
Right. So this was how the health officer coerced Nina into, quote unquote, committing herself to this detention hospital. He threatened her with putting this placard in front of her house. And again, that would be humiliating today, but it's hard to describe just how immensely humiliating that would be in the year 1918 when you couldn't print the word venereal disease in the radio or in the newspaper and you couldn't say it on the radio. This would have, you know, ended their social life and really hurt their livelihood. And so, of course, Nina committed herself to the Bay City Detention Hospital. It was never a true choice. It was highly coercive. So again, that was common at the time.
And that was common at the time. But again, this young woman, poor, I'm not sure how well educated she was.
She stopped school. She never graduated eighth grade.
Okay. She decides to take on the system.
That's right. She sues. And
with support. She gets financial support.
There's a wealthy middle-aged woman in her town who supports her financially and actually gives Nina a job and a place to live.
Elizabeth Beverly Barr.
Who later, her married name is Elizabeth Githens. And I've spoken with her great-granddaughter.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And they were kind of interested and excited to hear that she played this really important role. They'd never heard about this. But yeah, with the help of this Mrs. Githens, Nina somehow got the money to hire these three very powerful lawyers. And they sued the government. And this lands in the county courthouse in Gratiot County, Michigan.
And you were able to get your hands on court transcripts. I mean, and since that's the heart of the story.
That's right. That's the bedrock of this book is this trial transcript that I found in the archives of Michigan, which, you know, for a long time I was looking for the voices of women who were actually incarcerated under the American Plan. And over years of research in archives all around the country, I did eventually find many of these women's voices in trial transcripts and city council hearings and testimony to journalists. But Nina's transcript, when she sued the government, the record of that lawsuit is by far the most complete, the longest, and to me the most affecting. Nina speaks for almost 40 pages. So we really, you know, as best we can, get inside her head and see how she felt about being detained and labeled and tortured and then being forced to sue the government. Mm.
Well, and she sued, I guess, this Dr. Carney.
She sued Dr. Carney, who was the health officer. She sued Ida Peck, who was this government agent who'd been harassing her. And she sued Mary Corrigan, who was the superintendent of the detention hospital where she'd been housed.
Was there a lot of publicity about this trial?
There was, and that was part of Nina's bravery, was that she would have known, her lawyers would have told her that this would get her name in the press. You know, this was a time when local court appearances were very widely covered by the local press, and there were a number of weekly newspapers in her community, and then there were daily newspapers in places like Saginaw and in Detroit. And all of these newspapers covered her trial very closely. This was a matter of great public concern. People were watching this. And so Nina, who had only told her mother and a couple aunts where she'd spent these 3 months of humiliation, now had her name on the front page of newspapers all around the state of Michigan. And that is, to me, a real testament to her bravery.
What kinds of questions was she asked?
She was asked a lot of questions to try to paint her as a promiscuous woman. She was asked, you know, how many soldiers have you slept with? She was asked about, like, you know, somebody saw you out at night with this soldier, and somebody said you went for a car ride with this soldier, and did you ever sleep with this soldier? And they repeatedly pressed her on having sex with enlisted men in an attempt to what we would now call slut shame her.
Right.
It was not really relevant, except insofar as maybe that would label her, quote unquote, a reasonable suspicion of having an STI. But it was really a method of character assassination. It was a way of playing into stereotypes about young working class women and their sexual activity.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Scott Stern about his new book called The Trials of Nina McCall, and again, subtitled Sex Surveillance and the Decades-Long Government Plan to Imprison Promiscuous Women. The plan was called the American Plan. It was started around the time of the First World War and carried out through much of the 20th century, which is pretty shocking when you think about it. And again, any questions or comments or reactions, we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're talking about the American Plan, and let me just summarize it very briefly. It was started during World War I in this country when women deemed suspicious were forced to undergo exams for sexually transmitted infections. Many were detained, often without due process, treated or essentially mistreated while they were held in detention facilities. It lasted for much of the 20th century. It's estimated that tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of women were targeted by this program, most of them poor minorities. And Scott Stern is our guest, and that's what he writes about in his new book called The Trials of Nina McCall. And again, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can also check out some of the flyers and pictures that we have been posting on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages so that you can get a sense of what it is that we are talking about. Just a quick follow-up in terms of Nina's trial. She was asked all these questions, essentially what were you wearing type questions,
yeah, exactly.
That we know today. How did she handle that?
Nina handled it, I think, remarkably well, considering, again, like, those kinds of questions now are meant to humiliate someone. 100 years ago, they would have been endlessly more humiliating, especially when these kind of subjects were so stigmatized. Nina denied that she'd been having sex with soldiers, and she admitted being out with them and socializing with them sometimes. There were a lot of soldiers in her small town because they were manufacturing a lot of trucks there for the military. And Nina admitted, you know, being friends with some of them, but she denied having sex with them. And a lot of people now ask me, well, do you believe her? Do you think she's really having sex? And my answer to that is always like, it doesn't matter. The point is, whether she was doing it or not, the way that she was treated was completely unjustified. This was a way of controlling her sexuality when it's no one's business who an 18-year-old woman is having sex with. But, you know, so at 100 years later, it's impossible to know what exactly she was doing, but we do know that she denied it. And I have no evidence that Nina lied.
Well, we're talking about Nina because she went to court and there were transcripts and you've been able to build this story around her story. But as you have mentioned, most of the women targeted by this program, the American Plan, were not white women. They were really women of color or minorities.
Yeah. So, I mean, the plan almost exclusively locked up working class women. And then women of color, non-white women, were disproportionately locked up. And this played into horribly racist stereotypes about who was likely to be having promiscuous sex, who was likely to have STIs. The Surgeon General himself in the 40s talked about how black people are anatomically more likely to contract and transmit STIs. Mm. And, you know, there's a great dissertation that came out of the University of Texas at El Paso a couple years ago, where a historian very briefly looked at how the American Plan was enforced in El Paso during World War I. And what she found is not only were Mexican-American women more likely to be locked up, but the darker their skin, the longer they spent behind bars.
Wow. Wow. I mean, in certain ways, we should not be surprised.
No. I mean, you know, this is part of a pattern that has continued to this day. Women of color are still disproportionately locked up for selling sex and for many other crimes. And again, it plays into stereotypes about sexuality and quote-unquote deviance and all kinds of things.
Although the widow of Oscar Hammerstein was arrested in the 1930s, charged what, with prostitution?
Yeah, so she was
charged under the American Plan.
Well, so she was charged with prostitution, and then she was examined under the American Plan, under New York's American Plan law. So this was Oscar Hammerstein, the first widow. And what is telling about that case is it's a very rare example of a powerful and known woman being locked up under the American Plan. And whereas, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of women were locked up with little public outcry, when all of a sudden this famous, powerful woman is locked up, people all across New York are up in arms, and it ends up causing this 2-year investigation ordered by Governor Franklin Roosevelt, and it becomes this massive media scandal that actually causes the American Plan in New York to stop being enforced for about 2 years. Of course, they then started enforcing it again in 1934, but you know, it tells you a lot that when one powerful woman is locked up, you know, there's this huge outcry. But when thousands upon thousands of less powerful women are locked up, there isn't this outcry. I think that's very revealing.
And I do want to get to some calls, but let me just ask you about, was her name Billy Smith?
Yeah, there was a woman named Billy Smith. She's the woman who used the phrase, quote unquote, concentration camp. That's right. Billy Smith is another person who, much like Nina, resisted in a number of ways. She used the phrase concentration camp in her lawsuit, where she was suing people in Arkansas trying not to go to their quote unquote concentration camp. And then she escaped. And she hid out, actually. She crossed state lines to try to escape from the American Plan. And they caught her, but her resistance stands out and continues to inspire at least me to this day.
Because she was so defiant
and
so determined.
Because she was so defiant. That's right, yeah.
Let me see what Kelsey from Langhorne has to say. And Kelsey, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So my question is kind of a personal nature. As you were researching and writing this very difficult topic, how were you kind of frustrated, disheartened by the fact that so much of what happened then is really still happening to this day in terms of slut shaming, in terms of, you know, the greater penalties for women of minorities, and this also this sort of focus, as you said, about protecting our soldiers, you know, protecting our kind of war effort rather than a focus on domestic health, which I think you could say really continues to this day as well.
Well, Kelsey, I appreciate the call. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, it's immensely frustrating to see, you know, this horribly sexist program from 100 years ago or from 50 years ago largely continuing in a philosophy to this day. And we see it in laws like SESTA and FOSTA. There are laws that are being passed now that are making it much harder for sex workers to safely sell sex. And it is demoralizing. But I guess the way I see it is by trying to get more people to learn about the American plan and by educating people and spreading the word about this program that we can all pretty much unambiguously say was terrible,
right.
we can make people think about the policies that are still in force today, and we can make them realize that this has a legacy and this has ancestry, and that this is part of a legacy of oppression, and that perhaps we shouldn't be doing these things anymore. And I think educating people about the American plan can actually be very powerful.
Well, it is, and it's so many things, but one is about controlling women's bodies for
right.
one thing, and it's about how you treat women who are either sexual or deemed to be sexual.
That's right. I mean, this was begun at a time when rates of premarital sex were going up and rates of conventional marriage were going down. So this was always about controlling women who were not behaving according to the dominant social norms of the time. And again, we're seeing that today. Women who sell sex or women who are deemed to be promiscuous are treated worse by the criminal justice system. And I certainly don't have the solution to that, but I think by learning about our past and learning mm-hmm. about the American plan, perhaps we can get people to wake up and realize how just awful this is.
Kelsey, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. You just finished your first year at Yale Law School. I mean, is this the kind of law that you want to go into?
I'm not sure what kind of lawyer I want. I know that I want to do public interest law, like not work for a corporate firm. But,
right.
I've been studying a lot about environmental law, and I think that's important as well. Unfortunately, there's so many pressing issues that we all face today. But I'm continuing to do research along this avenue. And, you know, I just wrote a paper comparing examinations for STIs for women accused of prostitution versus examinations for STIs for men accused of rape. And I compared how courts have treated this over the century. And what you find is, unsurprisingly, they were incredibly sexist. Men often won lawsuits where they challenged these examinations, and women almost never won.
Wow. There is a case, and I remember this case. This is 1965. Andrea Dworkin, a well-known feminist activist at that time, was in San Francisco for an anti-war protest.
She was in New York, but right. Yeah.
She was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And she was forced to have a gynecological exam while in jail.
Right. So Andrea Dworkin, who later became a very prominent writer, I think probably most people have heard of her.
Sure.
She was 18 years old. She was a college freshman. She was in New York protesting the Vietnam War. And she was arrested and taken to New York's quote-unquote house of detention. And there, two male physicians subjected her to what she called a brutal examination. It was apparently an incredibly painful and humiliating gynecological exam for STIs. And this was
this part of the American plan?
Yeah, this was enabled by an American plan law that New York authorities were still enforcing in the mid-1960s, decades after the advent of penicillin. And so women who were diagnosed after being examined on these laws would no longer usually be held for weeks or months, but they would still be held for some period of time and forced to take treatment. And it was meant as a way of humiliating them. Mm-hmm. These laws were enforced in the 60s and 70s, often to harass people like Dworkin who were protesting the war. Black Panthers in California were harassed. Civil rights workers in Alabama were harassed using American plan laws. But what's amazing about Andrea Dworkin's case is that at the age of 18, she launched this media crusade to get this law to stop being enforced. And for a while, newspaper, you know, journalists and editors wouldn't even listen to her because she was an 18-year-old woman and they just didn't take her seriously. But she persisted, and after months, she got a number of newspapers to write about her, and the public got behind her cause. And in 1967, New York actually stopped enforcing its American plan law, largely because of the activism of Andrea Dworkin and other women like her.
Let me get Linda from Princeton to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Linda. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Marty, and to your guest. I tuned in late with a question, but I'm so upset about what I just heard about Andrea Dworkin.
Sure.
That sounds like legalized medical rape, plain and simple.
Not to argue. Yeah, but go ahead.
Yeah, I just wondered if your guest would tell us, to what extent have men ever been scrutinized in such a program? Women seem to be viewed irrationally, and it's sort of got a religious taint to it, as seductresses, temptresses. Are they viewed as the origin of all sexually transmitted diseases? We always forget that there are men involved, and I'm not judging anyone, but you can get an STD with just one sexual encounter, sure. a female can. So why is it assumed she's promiscuous? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Linda, thanks for the call. Yeah, we touched this earlier, Scott, but it bears underscoring.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. The vast majority of people locked up under the American Plan were women, and that's because of, you know, the popular opinion among the greatest public health authorities at the time was that women were disproportionately responsible for spreading these infections. Sometimes people said they were exclusively, and they made up these statistics saying like women are 90% of the cause of the spread of STIs. But of course, it takes two to tango. There are a couple of examples of men being locked up under the American Plan, not many, but a few. And what's really remarkable about those examples is that they often took place in places where there were broad efforts to control working class men. So one example is Seattle. In the 1910s, Seattle locked up a surprising number of men under the American Plan, but it was part of a program to police labor radicals. So they were targeting labor union members under the American Plan laws because it was just like one very easy way to harass people. But by and large, because of these stereotypes within the public health sphere, it was almost like very, very predominantly women being locked up.
One of the images that we posted is of Leesville. I printed it out. And those of you listening can go to our Facebook page or Twitter or our Instagram. And, you know, I've been to Auschwitz and I look at this and there's a looks like an armed guard in one corner of the image. A couple of women talking to each other. There's a sort of vaguely a medical looking man on the right hand side of the page. I mean, to me, this is frightening.
Yeah, it's frightening to see it now. What's really remarkable about that image of the Leesville Detention Hospital, which was a penal institution for women with STIs in Louisiana in the 1940s, what's remarkable about that picture is that it appeared in Collier's magazine
in
1943. This was a popular magazine. This was widely read. People knew about this. And this was just seen as like the way to control STIs during World War II. That institution was known to be particularly kind of gross. But it wasn't like an outlier by any means. Institutions in the 1940s, again, had barbed wire, armed guards. There were brutal punishments. And that image is rare, but it's not by any means an outlier.
Do these places still exist? I mean, maybe they're not holding, treating, mistreating, quote unquote, promiscuous women. But do the structures, do the facilities still exist?
Absolutely. In fact, where I'm from in Connecticut, where I live right now, the main women's prison is the York Correctional Institute in Niantic. That facility was built in 1918 specifically to lock up women under the American Plan. And that's very common across the country. The American Plan literally laid the groundwork for the expansion of mass incarceration of women in the 20th century. And so many of these institutions still exist. Some of them have been adapted into general prisons for men and women. Some remain women's prisons. Some became like hospitals. But a number of these institutions mm-hmm. still exist, and they kind of just blend into our communities, and we don't really know about them.
We're almost out of time here. Someone has bought the film rights to this story.
That's right.
Does that surprise you?
Yeah, it was hugely surprising. I wrote this book and was unsure if anyone would ever pick it up as a book. And then my literary agent said, "Well, why don't we send it out to some film producers?" So we talked to a film agent. And I had a very surreal week where we talked to a lot of like writers for Orange Is the New Black and people.
The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, no, I didn't talk to any. I don't know if that was on the air yet, actually, when we sold the film rights. But it has been optioned, which does not mean it'll get made. So many things get optioned that never get made. But it means it might get made. And theoretically, I should be seeing a script any day now. So I very much hope Nina's story will be taken to the big screen soon.
One little thing, and this is such a dorky thing to ask you, but I notice a lot of the notations in here include something about the weather. That the sun, it was sunny, it was rainy, it was cold, it was hot. Why did that matter to you?
Well, I wanted to set the scene. I wanted people to read this who weren't just academics. I wanted people who, you know, don't have graduate degrees in American history to be able to approach this story and to be able to understand it and also to enjoy it. So my approach was trying to tell it in as novelistic a way as possible. And sometimes that involved setting the scene with scenery. You know, there was bushes and there was a tree, but sometimes it was the weather. My mother, who was the only person I let read my drafts, made fun of me because I always like having the weather in there. But I think it's a good scene setting thing.
Well, I noticed it. Scott Cern, thank you so much. Thank you, first of all, for writing this book, and thank you for coming down to Philadelphia to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And he is a law student at Yale Law School, where he went to both graduate and undergraduate school, and it's where he learned about this story and became the book, The Trials of Nina McCall, Sex, Surveillance, and the Decades-Long Government Plan to Imprison quote-unquote promiscuous women. Again, go to Facebook or Twitter or to Instagram, and you can see some of the images that we were talking about during the show today. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you for joining us, and also Diana Martinez, our engineer.